Welcome to the History of Chemistry podcast. I'm Steve Cohen, your host, and this is episode 117, The Set Table, on a brief history of the layout of the periodic table. Thanks to those who already support this podcast. Supporters of this podcast can download a supplemental sheet with different periodic tables shown. Support the continuation of this podcast at Patreon. The website is www.patreon.com/ The History of Chemistry. If you have taken a high school or college chemistry class, even the most basic sort, you will have seen a periodic table in your textbook or hanging on the classroom wall. The periodic table is such an icon of modern chemistry that most of us take for granted that it has and always will look like what we've seen. But that's not the case. The periodic table is a human construct designed to show at a glance all sorts of properties of elements to help chemists immediately understand how these elements can react together and why. Perhaps there are other ways to diagram arrangements of elements to highlight such information. In fact, there are quite a few periodic tables of different sorts throughout the more than 150 years since Dmitri Mendeleev first invented one. Mendeleev's first attempt, handwritten in 1868 but published in 1869, was arranged like a spreadsheet. The rows were elements of similar chemical valence, and the columns were the nearby elements mostly in order by atomic weight. It's a chart that is rotated 90 degrees from what we know today. There were, however, no headers labeling the rows or columns. Lothar Meyer, who just missed inventing the periodic table, published a version in 1870 in Justus Liebig's Annalen der Chemie, which was rotated by 90 degrees from Mendeleev's 1869 version. The columns were the elements' valences labeled with Roman numerals I through IX, 1 through 9, but the rows were unlabeled. This is more like the modern diagrams we know. By 1871, Mendeleev rotated his periodic system, as many European languages call it, to that of Meyer. He too added headers for the columns, group 1, 2, 3, up to 8, the element's valences, along with denoting what chemical oxide formula the element formed with oxygen, from R2O, 2 atoms per oxygen, up to RO4, 1 atom per 4 oxygens. For the rows, he simply labeled them 1 through 12. No clear reason for the periodicity in valences was known at the time. Mendeleev's periodic system, or table, was not accepted in chemistry until roughly 2 decades later, when his ability to predict new elements using his table was demonstrated. His table is considered a short-form table. One of the clearest short-form tables was by J.W. Rettger in 1895. It has 7 columns, valences from 1 to 4 and back to 2, and 8 rows of elements. The known lanthanides are clustered in one square of the table, and chromium, manganese, iron, cobalt, and nickel are crammed into another square. The last periodic table Mendeleev himself published in 1906 finally includes the noble gases as group 0 because they were thought to be zero valent. Another oddity is that he thought there were many elements between hydrogen and helium, which he showed by dashes in those positions. Remember, this is before Henry Moseley uncovered the importance of atomic number in 1913. Ingo Haack published an interesting short periodic table in Scientific American in 1919, perhaps the first to distinguish the positions of the metals on the right from the nonmetals on the left, separated by the noble gas column. Underneath were the transition metals, lanthanides, and actinides. 1924 marks the year that what is now a classic American periodic table was published, Henry Hubbard's short version, going through a dozen editions through the rest of the century. Many, if not most, American classrooms and laboratories posted a large version of this on the wall. Obviously, if there is a short-form periodic table, there have to be other lengths. So let's consider the medium-length table. One of the earliest versions is P.J.F. Rang's arrangement from 1893. His has 17 columns because the noble gases were not yet discovered. Hydrogen is strangely in the column for valence 3 metals like gallium. Other than that, the layout is familiar to most of us, with the alkali metal column on the left and the halogen column on the right, plus the transition metals near the bottom in the middle. A.W. Stewart's 1920 attempt also looks vaguely familiar, except that the lanthanides are split into two rows. Glenn Seaborg's 1945 medium-length chart is the one we have come to know in countless textbooks and posters, in which the lanthanides and actinides are pulled down from the center into their own rows underneath the table to save width. He extended this medium-length table in 1976 for an extra row at the bottom, plus another pull-out row below the actinides, which he called the superactinides. For a different perspective on the medium-form table, Jean-Claude Jodogne turned it upside down in 1985 to show how the electron shells build up from the nucleus. Thus, the lighter elements are at the bottom, and the heavier ones reside at the top of the chart. Eric Sherry moved the halogens to the leftmost column, followed by the noble gases, then the alkali metals, in 2006, creating a more symmetric chart. Well, after the short and medium charts, we must now describe the long-form charts. Here, the lanthanides and actinides aren't pulled out of the table, like Alaska and Hawaii on maps of the USA. Instead, they remain in the chart. This makes the periodic table extremely wide and somewhat unwieldy, which is why you rarely see these examples. Frank Gooch and Claude Walker published an early example of this long chart in 1905 in their Inorganic Chemistry textbook. The table is almost like three tables side by side, the later understood to be S and P block elements, then the D block elements, and then the F block elements. At the same time, Alfred Werner of Inorganic Complex fame published the first modern-looking table of this type. By 1927, R.H. Leroy created a table which presaged Seaborg's view of lanthanides and actinides as analogous to each other, and put the noble gases in the middle as transitional elements from those with negative valences to those with positive valences. V. Romanoff in 1934 clearly showed the lanthanides over the actinides in rows for the first time. There is another type of periodic table called triangular. In this layout, the nonmetals and metals are differentiated, though connected with lines to show their mutual valences. One of the first chemists to create this style was Thomas Bailey in 1882. In 1895, Danish chemist Hans Peter Jürgen Julius Thomsen created such a triangular table with electronegative and electropositive elements clearly delineated. Niels Bohr created a triangular periodic table based on knowledge of electron shells in 1922. Emil Zmaczynski extended this a bit in 1935 into a pyramid shape, in which atomic number 0, perhaps a neutron, which has no charge and is not a proton, which defines atomic number, occupies the apex of the pyramid. I call out a more modern version of Bailey's and Bohr's table, created by William Jensen in 1987, which includes all elements known plus then undiscovered elements with placeholder numbers through element 118. Glenn Seaborg, the discoverer of radioactive elements we heard about, extended this table a couple of years later to include placeholders for undiscovered elements up to 168. German Heinrich Baumhauer in 1870 portrayed the elements as a spiral, starting with hydrogen in the center, with seven segments of the circular chart corresponding to the different valences that elements have. Some elements have multiple valences, which Baumhauer tried to show with arrows pointing here and there. Variations of Baumhauer's spiral continued to appear for several decades thereafter. Among important spiral charts are E. von Hutz from 1884, E. Loew's version from 1897, and George Stoney, who named the electron, even got into the act with a 1902 spiral, including quadrants called electronegative and electropositive. Recall that no obvious reason for the periodicity of elemental properties was known then. C.R. Nodder devised a variant in 1920 with a second loop for the transition metals. By this time, some vague ideas of electron shells were known. A modern and very cool spiral periodic table was constructed by Theodore Benfey in the early 1960s, taking into account the best knowledge of electron shells. In 1886, William Crookes of Crookes tube fame created an unusual diagram showing the elements wandering back and forth from a center line based on their response to external magnets and taking into account their valence. We have mentioned Alexandre-Émile Béguier de Champcourtois, who came up with a proto-periodic table in 1862, a three-dimensional screw or helix. J.H. Shepard in 1886 furthered this 3D model with a cut-out chart for the student to glue together into a cylinder shape. Henry Bassett in 1892 and then William Crookes in 1898 constructed a variant of this, a vis generatrix, Latin for generative force, in the form of a figure eight or infinity symbol. By 1911, Benjamin Emerson revised the Crookes model, making helical turns of various sizes. The first turns are standard eight-member turns, but then the helix widens in diameter to account for the transition metals. Another helical model from William Harkins and R. E. Hall in 1916 also includes narrower and wider helices. The vertical posts in the model demarcate the different groups of elements, and similar groups are joined via bridged rods. Distance across the vertical posts gives the atomic weight of the elements. Georg Schaltenbrand's helical variant of 1920 has an overall appearance of a cartoon tornado with helical turns of different diameters depending on the group of elements. Published in 1925 was M. Courtine's cutout model that appeared in the form of a submarine with a conning tower or maybe a castle. A top view of the scheme prefigures John Clark's flat model of 1935, which I discuss later in this episode. The physicist George Gamow created one that appears in the form of a ribbon listing the elements spiraling around in 1940. Roy Alexander extended this idea with his 3D model, showing the different elements' outer shells in different colors in 1965.
We'll be right back. Hi, and welcome to Hiss and Tell, a cat podcast where we delve deep into the fascinating world of feline behavior with your host, me, Christina Wilson, a professional animal behaviorist. Each episode features insightful discussions with leading veterinarians, dedicated researchers and scientists, experts in cat behavior and training, and so much more. Join me as we decode the complexities of pet loss, unravel the mysteries of feline health and behavior, and discover the latest research findings. I'll meet you at Hiss and Tell.
By 1928, with the electron shells of the elements becoming better understood, O.J. Stewart published a photo of his helical model, something like a fir tree, with a point at the top for hydrogen and expanding helical turns toward the bottom as the elements get heavier and more complicated, built with lead shot denoting the elements. For multiple isotopes of a single element, Stewart clustered several lead shot together. We might consider Charles Janet's spiral chart of 1929 as a hybrid of the well-known table with the earlier purely spiral methods. Here the standard chart is merely curved around so that the alkali metals, group 1, and alkaline earths, group 2, meet the lanthanides and actinides. Emil Kohlweiler tried a three-dimensional representation which blends the flat chart with height by folding bridges between flat levels. One bridge is the trio of similar metals, iron, cobalt, and nickel. Another is the entire lanthanide series. A third are the elements uranium and protactinium. For another three-dimensional way to represent the elemental periodicity, try J.A.N. Friend's 1925 view of the elements as placed on a globe. Around the North Pole, hydrogen, are placed the low-mass elements from helium to fluorine. As you work your way south, the elements get heavier to the equator, where you find barium, tin, and iodine. Just south of the equator are the rare earth metals, and heavy elements like uranium and radium are found near the South Pole. Courtine's rather architectural model perhaps inspired chemists later in the century, for there is Szabo and Lakatos's 1954 version like a Soviet apartment block, Mary Secker's version of 2003 that looks like a building, Ala el-Din Ali Mohammed's 2003 double amphitheater-like construction, and Michael Aldersley's 2011 patented version of a table looking like four separate buildings. With the 1930s, the periodic models get ever more creative, perhaps. John Clark, who was a rocket fuel chemist and science fiction writer, invented what is called a racetrack chart, a variant of the spiral form, but with elongated loops for transition metals. The lanthanides and actinides were compressed into small areas. This chart became popular in the mid-20th century after Life magazine featured an article in Post-Atom Bomb 1949 on The Atom, in which Clark's chart was colorized and expanded. Something like this, with hints of the old spiral form, was also published in 1939 by Gordon Irwin in the Journal of Chemical Education with some quality calligraphy. L. Talpain, in 1945, published a three-dimensional array of elements reminiscent of Friend's globular model, but inverted and called a mnemonic classification of the elements. At the bottom of the array is the K electron shell with hydrogen and helium. As you work your way to the top of the array, each level is another electron shell up through shell Q, or radium. A layered variant of the flat long form table was created by A. Ringley in 1949, which has each outer electron shell as a layer on top of the previous layer. Paul Giguère showcased his 3D model in 1965, constructed vaguely like a weather vane. The S-block elements are one vane attached to the central pole, the P-block elements are another, The D block elements are a third, and the F block elements are a fourth flag from the pole. Charles Gregg published his periodic pyramid in 1983 as part of the annual Instruments for Research and Industry, or I2R, calendar. You cut out the polygon and glued it together into a square pyramid like the Egyptian ones in Giza. Each of the four sides represent S block, P block, D block, and F block elements. I have one of these pyramids. I also remember the I2R calendars, which included scientific cartoons for each month, plus a bonus page such as the cutout periodic table. They were popular in the 1980s and 1990s. Speaking of I2R, their 1989 calendar included a so-called physicist's periodic table by Timothy Stowe. I know there are a few of you physicists who listen to this podcast. This was also a three-dimensional version with the outer electron shells as levels. Why for physicists? Instead of focusing on valence and reactivity of the elements, this one includes directionality for the other electron quantum numbers and color coding for the S, P, D, F electrons. Such information is of value for atomic spectroscopy. This is a great example of how the table's layout caters to specific users. In 1972, Tang Hua Kao revealed another spatial method of showing the elements, somewhat reminiscent of Gamow's 1940 drawing. This version, though, hinges on 8 segments per turn. A spiral variant based on hexagonal tiling was invented in 1999 by Jeff Moran. This one follows the general spiral method of hydrogen in the middle, but lays the elements out one to a hexagonal tile, like an incomplete old bathroom floor. Finally, I note Anthony Granger's 2019 version that is plotted at the intersection of 3 orthogonal planes. On the floor plane is the main part of the table, in color-coded rings for the outer electron shells as elsewhere. The transition metals occupy color-coded rings on the right wall. The lanthanides and actinides sit on the left wall, also in color-coded circles. Clearly, there are hundreds of ways to display the periodicity of the elements, depending on what property you wish to emphasize. The table we have seen in our classrooms and textbooks is a human-invented construct, and only one possible, if eminently practical, way to plot things. To see all these and many more tables, try the Internet Database of Periodic Tables. A May 1934 article called Types of Graphic Classifications of the Elements in the Journal of Chemical Education also is valuable. In our next episode, we stick to the topic at hand, and I hope to keep you glued to my episode, for we speak of the history of adhesives. Until then, brave the elements! Thank you for listening to the History of Chemistry Podcast.